Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's premier public affairs forum. I'm Murray Ross, director of the Kaiser Permanente Institute for Health Policy, and we welcome our audience here on the radio and on the internet, and we invite everyone to visit us at commonwealthclub.org. For those of you following the health reform debate, you may have heard the term Accountable Care Organizations, or the acronym ACOs. The health reform law envisions these new organizations as a way to bring providers, physicians, and hospitals together and hold them accountable for the quality and cost of services they provide. Our speaker today has been studying health systems around the world, many of which embody elements that we seek to develop here in these new organizations. Chris Hamm is the Chief Executive Officer of the King's Fund, a charitable foundation in England, and he's held that post since April 2010. He's been a professor of health policy and management at the University of Birmingham, England, since 1992. And for the first half of this decade, he was seconded to the Department of Health in England, where he directed the strategy unit as they unfolded their health reform law. He has advised the World Health Organization and the World Bank and served as a consultant to governments in a number of countries. Chris has devoted his career to studying performance improvement and leadership in England, in the United States, and around the world. And we look forward to his comments on what lessons that can offer the United States. Chris?
Well, thank you very much to Norma and Murray for the opportunity and the welcome and the introduction. I'm very pleased to be here, delighted to have the opportunity to offer some of my thoughts on the issue of accountable care organisations and accountable care systems. I am a reasonably regular visitor, not just to the United States, but to Northern California, mainly because of a fairly long-term partnership there has been between the National Health Service in my country and Kaiser Permanente, going back to 2002-2003. And it's been very productive. It's been a two-way partnership. We've learned a great deal from the association we've had with Kaiser Permanente. I'll reflect a little bit on that. And I know colleagues from Kaiser have also learnt as part of their involvement with my healthcare system back in the United Kingdom. So when Murray suggested this, I thought a little bit about the topic and the focus for the remarks I want to make today. And I've been following from a distance the debate about healthcare reform here and the debates not just on the coverage side but on the delivery system reform side, and decided to focus very much on the latter. I'll talk for about 30 minutes or so, offering, as I say, some reflections, some comparisons, some ideas that I've gained from my work in a number of different countries, and I hope that might then provoke some questions and from some challenges from you. So the starting point for me is that in the United Kingdom, and indeed most of the other countries that I have the privilege of working with and working in Europe, in Australasia, Canada has been mentioned as well, we have to a large extent solved the coverage problem. We've solved the coverage problem because governments in those countries for many years have decided, because of the well-known problem of market failure in healthcare coverage, healthcare insurance, that there is a need for intervention in the market, for government to regulate and government to legislate to ensure that all citizens have access to necessary medical care. In my country, that happened in 1948 as part of the post-war settlement, and current generations take it for granted that the government will have a major role in ensuring universal coverage within healthcare systems. So for us, it's been much more interesting to follow your debate about delivery system reform and payment reform, because those are the challenges that we have. Once you've achieved universal coverage, how do you ensure that you use healthcare resources as efficiently as possible, that you give your citizens good access, timely access to high-quality healthcare services? What are the mechanisms and the payment systems that will enable you to deliver good value for money within whatever the envelope of resource is that governments and other agencies commit to healthcare? Hence the interest in accountable care organizations. organizations or accountable care systems, the work that people like Steve Shortell, Elliot Fisher, Mark McClellan, and others have been contributing to in a very interesting way from our point of view, and I know from yours too, over recent years. And my reflection on this is that in the United Kingdom, in the Nordic countries like Sweden and Denmark, in New Zealand, there are organizations that go under various names. So in my country, we call them at the moment primary care trusts, and in the past we call them district health authorities. In the Nordic countries, they're called variously county councils or municipal councils. And in New Zealand at the moment, they're called district health boards. And all of these different organizations share some of the same characteristics. They are responsible for providing health care for defined populations based in geographical areas. They are responsible for the full continuum of health care, from prevention at one end to highly specialized tertiary care at the other. And by the way, within that continuum of care, in all of these systems, there is a strong commitment to primary care, a belief that primary care should be the bedrock of a well-functioning, high-performing healthcare system. The organizations I've referred to have one other characteristic in common. They have full capitation. I think that's the way you would probably put it. They work with a fixed budget. Resources are allocated often from government to these organizations, and then they're responsible for their defined populations delivering the full continuum of care. Now, we haven't called any of these organizations accountable care organizations, but I think they meet the criteria that people like Steve Shortell and others have written about when they recommended migration in the direction of ACOs within your delivery system debate. And I was interested to pick up recently some comments from Ian Morrison, actually citing Mark Smith, President and CEO of the California Healthcare Foundation. And you'll forgive me if I just read out this two sentences from what Mark said. Ian used these sentences to endorse, I think, his own views about the debate on accountable care organizations. What Mark said is that the accountable care organization is like a unicorn, a fantastic creature that is vested with mythical powers. And he added, but no one has actually seen one. Well, I have news for Mark. I've seen them. I've seen them in New Zealand. I've seen them in the Scandinavian, Nordic countries, and I've seen them in the United Kingdom too. As I say, we don't use the language, but they have most of those key characteristics. So they're not mythical, they're not fantastical, and nor are they perfect. And that, in a way, is the theme I want to explore in my remarks today. What they do, whatever they're called, is try and pursue the IHI's triple aim objectives. They're there to improve the health of the defined populations they serve. They're there to improve patient experience, responsiveness and quality of care, patient safety. And they're there, of course, to work within fixed budgets to control healthcare costs. So let me begin by talking about what the experience has been in the countries that have accountable care organizations or something like them. And I'm going to give you a short version here of a much longer, a more complex, a more interesting story, because time is limited today. So how would I summarize the experience, the performance of accountable care organizations outside the United States? The first thing to say is undoubtedly they perform well when it comes to ensuring equity of access to care for citizens, for the population. And also they perform well on cost control. Now, neither of those observations is surprising if you start from the position that all of these countries have a single-payer, usually tax-funded healthcare system, that the accountable care organizations have budgets which are literally fixed, not open-ended. They're mandated. And also, they have mandated universal population coverage. The other characteristic in these systems is either there are no co-pays for patients and users when they access healthcare, or those co-pays are very limited indeed. So in my country, there are hardly any co-pays at all. Virtually all healthcare services, primary care, hospital, are literally free at the point they are used by patients and by service users. There are very limited co-pays for things like dental care and the cost of prescription drugs. But even if you look at the cost of prescription drugs in England, 80% of prescriptions are free because they are for groups that are exempt from the requirement to pay a co-pay for those drugs. So good performance on equity of access and on cost control. What about timeliness of access to care, responsiveness, how long people may have to wait for an appointment with the family physician or to wait for their hospital treatment? Well, here the record is more variable, and it will depend a little on which of the countries I've cited that you focus on. So the Nordic countries generally have a very good record. They do provide timely access to care at all points. In the United Kingdom, until quite recently, access to care has been much poorer. And we've had very long queues and waiting lists, particularly for non-urgent medical treatment, not for urgent needs, because there's a timely response to those. But historically, not such a good record around access to care and responsiveness. Now, that has changed, and in my country over the last decade, a significant investment, so now very good access to healthcare. If I tell you in England, patients who turn up at the emergency room, almost all will be seen and treated within a maximum of 4 hours. That's the target that our government has set. If you want an appointment with your primary care physician in my country, that generally happens within 2 days. And if you want to see a nurse in primary care instead of going to see the physician, it's usually within 24 hours. If you're waiting for your hospital procedure, now that's done very, very quickly by comparison with a decade ago. So access to care is not as good as we would like it to be, but it's certainly improved greatly. And in all of these different countries, progress has been made. What about another metric? How well do they do on population health? Measures like life expectancy and infant mortality. Well, some of these countries do exceptionally well. The Nordic countries stand out in that regard. A very good record of achievement around life expectancy, very low infant mortality. Generally, health in the Nordic countries is at the top of the range when you look at the OECD comparisons. Not so good in New Zealand and in the United Kingdom, but continuing to improve, and in both countries, better than you see when you look at the same data for the United States. When I come on to talk about quality of care and how efficiently resources are used by accountable care organisations in these countries, then it's a harder judgment to make because we've only recently started measuring quality of care and efficiency, and there aren't any widely accepted metrics that I'm aware of which would enable us to make broad brush international comparisons. And I'll come back to talk about that in a moment. So if you weigh all those considerations together, the conclusion I would reach is that on some indicators, those countries and their organisations perform very well, and others less so. There's quite a lot of variation, both between countries and within countries. So I would suggest to you that the lesson to take is that accountable care organisations may be a necessary condition as we move towards the triple aim and seek to improve how well health systems perform, but they are not a sufficient condition. Other things need to be in place to provide the stimulus for performance improvement. So that has led to an ongoing process of delivery system reform in all of these different countries. And I'm going to summarise this again very succinctly, I hope, very briefly, by highlighting four main themes in that process of delivery system reform. The first is a strong focus on what we would call performance management of accountable care organisations, particularly by higher levels of government. And in England, we have a very colloquial way of expressing this. We talk about the regime of targets and terror in the English National Health Service, by which I mean government setting ambitious targets for improving access to care. to cut waiting times at different points in the healthcare system, and then managing the implementation of those targets in a very directive way. And essentially, if you're a CEO of a hospital and you do not do well on those targets, you probably won't be in your job next year to try and improve on how you did. So very active performance management, which lies behind the real progress in the English healthcare system, starting from a very low base in providing much more timely and responsive health services. So that first strategy then, performance management through targets and terror. A second strategy has been the focus on measuring performance, being much more transparent about performance and variations between hospitals and different organisations, and then using that data to benchmark performance, to compare how different organisations do on the metrics I've been describing. Now, in England, we call this naming and shaming healthcare organisations to improve, embarrassing them by showing they're not doing as well as others. I think in New Zealand they have an even better way of expressing this. I was there 2 or 3 years ago, and the way they talk about measurement and transparency is ranking and spanking. And Sweden, of course, doesn't use anything like that in the way of its phraseology, but actually it probably does better at measurement and benchmarking than any of the other countries that I'm aware of. A long tradition in Sweden of measuring quality of care through the professional medical associations, very active, developed bottom-up within that country. Lots of quality registers they've developed, which tell you in great detail about the comparative performance of physicians and the hospitals in which they work. And they use that transparent measurement to help to stimulate performance improvements. So this is what some people, I think, would call yardstick competition, stimulating change in that way. The third strand in delivery system reform is what I will call quasi-market reforms in delivery systems. And you can see examples of this in all of the countries that I've referred to. What do I mean by quasi-market reforms? Well, I'm not talking about changes to the payment systems, the funding mechanisms, because all of these countries are still committed to tax-funded single-payer healthcare. What I mean by quasi-market reforms is accepting public financing as the main way of paying for healthcare to ensure equity of access, making changes to the delivery system to drive improvements in performance in three ways. First of all, separating the function of the payer from the function of the provider. Historically, they've often been integrated into a single organisation. But for 20 years in my country and a similar length of time in the Nordic countries and in New Zealand, there have been efforts to separate those two to create the conditions for payers to create the basis for competition between providers. A second element in those reforms has been the expansion of patient choice. Against the background of quite limited choice in most countries, expanding the opportunities for citizens to go to different hospitals or to different physicians where that is their preference. And linked to that, a third change has been greater diversity among those who provide healthcare, not just sticking with publicly owned hospitals and physicians, but wanting to encourage privately owned providers to come in to compete for patients and to be paid for by the public payers of care. And the other change has been to reform payment systems, how money flows around. And the phrase that's often used is that money should follow patients. Money should follow patients to the physician of their choice or to the hospital of their choice to reward those who deliver more accessible, responsive, higher quality care. And Alan Enthoven, who's with us today, has been one of the key figures in the debate about quasi-market reforms, both in my country and in some of the other systems. Now, I would say, if you look at the evidence, the impact of these quasi-market reforms has been much more variable than the impact of performance management or indeed of measurement and transparency and benchmarking, often because these reforms have not been well designed or well implemented by the politicians who steer the future of these healthcare systems. The fourth theme in reform is learning from other countries' experience. And this, of course, is what I referred to right at the beginning, the partnership, a very productive partnership there has been between the English health system and Kaiser Permanente, particularly focused around how we can learn from the Kaiser model of integrated care as we try and improve performance in my healthcare system. Started by Richard Feacham and his colleagues, who published a fascinating paper in the British Medical Journal in 2002, making the claim that Kaiser delivered more return on its investment in healthcare resources than the English Health Service did at that point, stimulating a great deal of interest and debate, as you may be aware. Lots of correspondence on the pages of the British Medical Journal, raising big questions about how well-founded that comparison was. But nevertheless, setting us off on a journey that has been very fruitful, certainly from our point of view, in trying to understand what we can learn from Kaiser and its integrated model of care. And one part of the English health system now delivering really good results as a consequence of that. So those four themes in health reform. Where we are now in my country is our coalition government, which was elected in May last year, so it's been in office now for almost a year, is embarking on very radical further changes. Doesn't believe that what it inherited is going to deliver the right level of performance that people have a right to expect in England. And there's an interesting paper in the New England Journal of Medicine last week by two of my colleagues back home, Martin Rowland and Rebecca Rosen, describing rather well the nature of those changes and what they might mean for the English National Health Service. Essentially, our current version of the ACO, the Primary Care Trust, is about to be abolished. It's going to be replaced with entirely new organisations, networks of primary care physicians. And all primary care physicians in England will be required to be a member of a network. This will not be optional. And those networks will take over many of the responsibilities which the primary care trusts have at the moment. So primary care physician networks will hold the budget. They will serve a defined population. They won't hold all of the budget. They'll control about 60 to 70% of the total healthcare resource. The remainder will be controlled nationally by a newly established NHS commissioning board, which will be responsible for buying more specialised services that cannot be purchased by the local networks of primary care physicians. So the essence of these changes is that we have 150 primary care trusts today. They will be replaced by about 300 of these new networks of primary care physicians, and they effectively will be primary care-led, physician-led, accountable care organisations. A major change, massive organisational upheaval in prospect over the next 2 years. The target date is all of this takes effect fully in April 2013. And this is a big change for a system serving about 50 million people. You might ask, what's the rationale for such a big change? Well, you might well ask, what's the rationale for such a big change? I know some of you may have been following this debate from afar. The reality is that the performance of the English health system has improved out of all recognition in the last decade through substantially increased expenditure linked to many of the changes that I was describing earlier on. And the Commonwealth Fund's international comparisons, I know they're not without controversy, suggests that in the group of countries that the Commonwealth Fund looks at, the UK now comes out second in a group of about 8 countries, using various metrics of performance. And Jay Crossan, who's with us today, was also with us in the UK about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And we heard Sir Bruce Keogh, who is the medical director for the National Health Service across the whole of England. Bruce is a cardiac surgeon by training. and he recounted his personal experience as a practicing clinician 10 years ago, working in Birmingham, the city where I've been based for much of my career, diagnosing a patient who turned up in his hospital clinic, and then meeting the patient, let's assume on this occasion it was a man, with his wife, to break the news that, yes, surgery was needed for his heart condition. But sadly, he would have to wait, and this is going back to the year 2000, up to 2 years before he could be admitted to the local hospital for that very urgent treatment to be provided. And Bruce will go on to say the same patient today in that same hospital comes along, is diagnosed, the same consequence follows, and he's sitting in the clinic with the patient and the patient's wife and says, yes, you need the operation. Can you come in next week? And that's the degree of improvement there has been in the performance of the English health system through a combination of much more expenditure, big investment, and reform too. So many people have been arguing the case for radical change, further change, has not been made against that background of substantial change and improvement under the previous government. But in any case, change is going to go ahead. Our Prime Minister, David Cameron, Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, we have a Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition, are both committed to further reform. And not just getting rid of the existing organisations and the new networks of primary care physicians taking on the budgets and that responsibility, but strongly emphasising the quasi-market reforms. Their belief is that we still need a good dose of patient choice and provider competition to improve the system even further. And the risk in all of that is we end up with more fragmentation of care, rather than greater integration of care. So the learning and the adaptation of the Kaiser Permanente approach will become more difficult in future if these reforms go ahead. So where next for the English National Health Service? Well, here I want to draw on a paper that I co-authored, published in the British Medical Journal 2 weeks ago. My fellow authors were Jennifer Dixon, who is the chief executive of the Nuffield Trust, another health foundation, and Sir Cyril Chantler, who has been involved in health policy and health leadership for many years as one of our most eminent physician leaders. And what we argued in the BMJ paper is we need to move towards what we were calling clinically integrated systems of care at a local level within the national framework. Based on these emerging networks of primary care physicians, but with six characteristics that we felt were important to emphasise. The first is they shouldn't just be networks of primary care physicians. If we're serious about greater clinical integration, we have to find a better way of bridging the historical divide in British medicine between primary care physicians who work in the community and specialist physicians who generally work in hospitals and are employed by hospitals. So we were arguing strongly to migrate towards multi-specialty medical practice, much greater integration between primary and secondary care, with multi-specialty groups taking on budgets and being able to decide what to provide directly themselves through their own expertise and what to commission or buy from other providers. The second characteristic for us would be physicians shouldn't be required to work together with other physicians simply because they work in the same area. The networks of physicians, primary care and secondary care, should be established through like-minded practices choosing to come together, belief that they can deliver improvements if they collaborate in that way. My reflection, and perhaps an issue that you'd want to comment on, is I don't believe that Kaiser would have achieved the results it has if Kaiser was a geographical monopoly serving certain defined areas in California. There's a selection effect in the Kaiser system. Physicians choose to apply to be part of the Permanente Medical Group, and the Permanente Medical Group chooses to hire certain physicians and not others. So it's about that natural choice and the affinity of physicians who want to work together, rather than, as it's been proposed in my country, a requirement that physicians who work in the same area should be involved in these emerging networks and groups. Third condition should be the possibility of choice between competing clinically integrated systems, because it's integration that's important, but as Anna Enthoven has said on many occasions, it's that combination of integration and competition that lies behind the performance that we observe within Kaiser Permanente. And this is linked to my second point, because there will not be the possibility of choice of patients between competing clinically integrated systems if they are, in effect, monopolies within certain cities or counties. You need a degree of overlap between different networks to create that possibility. Fourthly, these organisations need to be working within a framework of incentives that rewards high performance and that rewards collaboration between physicians on the one hand and the hospitals on the other hand. And I'll come back and say a bit more about that. Physician groups will need great management support to take on their responsibility, because it will be a distraction for the physician leaders to get involved in many of the transactional issues around the work they've been asked to assume. And they'll need support. This is the sixth characteristic from the proposed National Commissioning Board, working across the whole of England, acting, if you like, as a large health insurer within my system, providing some of the resources that I know health insurers provide to medical groups in different parts of the United States. Now, these ideas that I've written about with Jennifer Dixon and Cyril Chandler are not at the heart of our government's current plans. The point of writing the article was to suggest it might be possible to migrate in this direction, which would be more positive in terms of our ability to deliver a more integrated system, delivering good results for the population served. And what's very interesting is that only a week ago, the Prime Minister decided in a way that is unprecedented to introduce what's been called a pause in the passage of the legislation that's going through Parliament at the moment to implement the radical changes. Unprecedented because normally in our political system, the government will consult, then it will publish its proposals, and then the legislation will be announced and Parliament will debate and approve and amend. This time round, the proposals were published first, then the legislation, and now the consultation is taking place. And that reflects the deep concern on the part of many stakeholders with the risks involved in this kind of programme. I was in Boston, in Massachusetts, a month or so ago with a group of primary care physicians from the northwest of England, from the beautiful Lake District in Cumbria. We went to have a look at how medical groups in Massachusetts work under capitated budgets to see what lessons there might be for our primary care physicians as they take on their new responsibilities. And we were particularly interested in the use of the alternative quality contract by Blue Cross Blue Shield, creating exactly that framework of incentives that we need to adapt to create the framework within which medical groups will perform well, are incentivized to do so, and are incentivized also to work in collaboration with their local hospitals to deliver more integrated care. We came back from that visit with the idea of establishing the Cumbria Accountable Care System, an accountable care system that would bring GPs together with specialists and which would enable them to work productively with their local hospitals to deliver higher quality results and better outcomes for the population they serve. It remains a very open question as to whether this will be possible because, as I've said already and I will repeat, our government is very committed to expand choice, competition, which in its current design is likely to mean more fragmentation, to make it difficult for multi-specialty medical groups to come together and then to work productively with their local hospital services. And that lies behind the concerns that have been expressed. So I'm conscious of the time. Let me try and summarise some of the key lessons and then make one final observation and conclusion. I hope what I've been able to suggest today is first of all Accountable care organisations exist. Maybe not quite here in the way that some people have been advocating, but they certainly exist in other countries. There is hard empirical evidence on which to draw to support your thinking and your debate as you move forward in the next stage of delivery system reform. The ones that I've been most familiar with, most involved with, have achieved a great deal, certainly in controlling costs of healthcare and ensuring equity of access. They've also had a reasonably good performance on the other metrics. But more is needed than just the infrastructure of the accountable care organisation to deliver the ongoing continuous improvements in performance that policymakers, patients, stakeholders all seek. And that's why there has been this focus on delivery system reform. Many different examples, the targets and the terror, the measurement and the transparency, the quasi markets, and all of those have worked up to a point in terms of better responsiveness and better quality of care, but this is work in progress. There is much more still to do. There are the contradictions in England in wanting to learn about more integrated models of care, but also the risk of fragmentation if the market-based reforms go forward in the way that's currently proposed. There are some very obvious perverse incentives in my system. You know, our hospitals are paid on the basis of their activity. There's fee-for-service reimbursement of acute hospital care in the English healthcare system at the very time when we're trying to reduce our reliance on hospitals and provide more care in primary care and more care in the community. So payment reform, to come back to that, is just as important as delivery system reform. The current plans for primary care physicians to take on budgets to become embryonic accountable care organisations could take us in the right direction. They will have responsibility for defined populations. They will have a fixed budget. They will have many of the characteristics. If they can build bridges into the work of hospital-based specialists and build the integration of care that we saw examples of in Massachusetts on that recent visit. So there are ways forward here, but times are challenging and times are threatening in many respects. My final thought, if you go back to the premise of my discussion today, if you accept the really big challenges in healthcare, wherever you are to do with delivery system reform and payment reform, then I would suggest that neither accountable care organisations nor the clinically integrated systems that we've been advocating back home will be the last word in the debate about reform, and they're certainly not a quick fix to the many problems that we all confront. If you have accountable care organisations without choice and competition, which has been the predominant model in the countries I've been describing, there has to be a proxy for the market to stimulate the performance improvements that the market brings where it works at its best. The problem with that, in many of the countries, like the Scandinavian countries, like New Zealand, despite the flirtation with quasi-market reforms, there is an aversion on the part of many politicians and many citizens to the application of market principles in healthcare. There is just not the support and the commitment to going down that route, which means that the proxies that I've been referring to is where the focus is in stimulating accountable care organisations to tackle many of the challenges they're faced with. But in England, where there isn't that aversion to the use of competition, where there is active support for choice and competition, the risk, frankly, as I've alluded to, is that we will introduce the wrong kind of competition. We need to have a more sophisticated debate about the point at which choice can exert the most positive leverage in healthcare, especially in a national health service such as the one that I am familiar with. And sadly, we're not having that degree of sophistication in the debate. My personal view is that choice between accountable care organisations offers a much more promising route to reform than offering choice between a fragmented, diverse array of physicians, practices, hospitals, and other healthcare providers. Some of that may be important. Some of it may bring benefits. But we need to think about choice at the level of the system and the accountable care organisation, and then allow those systems to achieve the integration which will bring the return around improvements in quality and accessible, responsive services. Whether we can get there or not, well, much hinges on the pause that I left behind 3 or 4 days ago, and the willingness of our current political leaders to have fresh and perhaps some more radical thoughts about how competition and choice can be applied, with the likelihood of that delivering real results that will build on success and avoid the risks that are ever present within the current trajectory of reform. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. We have time for audience questions, and as people are gathering thoughts, maybe I'll ask you for 30 seconds on where's the British public on this?
Yeah. The British public has a love-hate relationship with the National Health Service. And what I mean by that, Murray, is that the public love the fact the health service is there for them. It gives them a degree of comfort and security to know if they become unwell, there is a publicly funded healthcare system that will respond quickly to their needs, where there are no worries about co-pays or the cost of care. So that creates, I think, a very deep affection. They hate it when it doesn't deliver quite the responsive, high-quality service they would like it to. But increasingly, as I've said, that is the exception rather than the rule. One of our former Conservative politicians in his memoirs said that the National Health Service is the closest thing we have to a national religion in England, because people do feel very strongly. And if you look at the survey evidence, how does the health service compare with the public's views on the monarchy, for example, or the British Broadcasting Corporation? It's way higher in the estimation of the public. So you mess with the National Health Service at your peril if you're a government that has radical reforming intentions, because the public will quickly blame you if things start to go wrong. And that surely is why the Prime Minister now has had some second thoughts and is going through this listening exercise to really understand why people have such concerns and what might be done about them.
Jay Crossan from Kaiser Permanente. Chris, I struggled to find a question since I pretty much agree with everything you said, certainly about the value of integration, which we're now calling, for better or worse, accountable care organizations, and the issue of competition. Competition at the point of choice between systems. One of the questions I get a lot here, and I think it applies as well to the UK, is, we can understand how that works in the San Francisco Bay Area or in Boston where it does work, or where it could work in New York City, for example, where we don't have it right now. But it's a little harder to envision how it works in more rural areas or places where there's less population concentration. We have plenty of those. And I saw some of those on the trip with you in England. So the question is then, do we need to think about two different models of competition, one that would apply where there is enough volume of patients to have competing systems, and something else in other areas, or is there some model that would essentially be, you could stretch it, you know, to all areas?
Yeah. It's a good question. My thinking on that is, yes, there is exactly the difference you've described between the more urban and rural areas. And only in those more densely populated urban areas is there the potential for the emergence of these competing clinically integrated systems, if I use my language, not your language. And if you're in a rural county, a remotely not densely populated area, the likelihood is you will have a clinically integrated system there, one accountable care organisation. Does that create a problem? Well, it might do, because that could be a monopoly system that delivers poor quality care. People can't vote with their feet. And the suggestion we put forward is that you use the benchmarks of performance that emerge in the urban areas where there is real competition. And you apply those benchmarks in the rural areas, and you use that to challenge the accountable care organizations that are monopolies in the rural areas to up their game and to emulate what you can see in the more competitive areas. If indeed, and I think it's still an empirical question for us, if indeed you see the more competitive arrangements delivering better results than the less competitive ones, because there are quite strongly held different views on this. In my country, you know, some people say integration on its own will deliver the substantial improvements we are seeking in future. Other people feel equally strongly that integration without competition will take us to the bad old days when we had these slow-moving, lethargic, sclerotic district health authorities that really didn't do a great job. So I think these are empirical questions, and the opportunity to have competition in urban areas and not in rural areas provides a wonderful opportunity for health service researchers to evaluate different models.
Thank you for your presentation. I wondered how you handle what we call elective surgery, something like a facelift here,
yep,
which we have to pay for now.
Yeah. It depends on your definition of elective surgery. So for us, elective surgery covers a very wide range of possible treatments. I mean, the big examples would be in orthopedics, cataract surgery would be examples. They're all part of the National Health Service, if that's your question. Those are precisely the procedures in the past where there were long queues for treatment, but where now access to care is much easier and much faster than it ever has been. There is some debate at the margins as to what will be in the benefits package to be funded under the National Health Service, and what will be left out that people will have to pay for separately out of their own pockets. But actually, we have a very comprehensive benefits package. There are very few examples of services that would not be funded under the public scheme.
All right, Alan Inhoven, may I just follow up on Jay's good question and your response? What came to my mind, place I don't know enough about, but I've observed some, is the state of Wisconsin, which is basically a rural agricultural state with a few cities. And they have sprinkled out through there, possibly by historical accident or whatever, the Marshfield Clinic, which has a central mother church with the specialists and so forth, and also a far-reaching, spread-out primary care outposts, and the Dean Clinic, which has primary care outposts and several other group health north and south, or central and south, you know. And somehow integrated systems have grown up there, I guess, with enough outreach to members. So something like that might to be made to work, because it's not so much head-to-head competition, but it's contested. Dean could take some territory, could move in on Marshfield's clinic territory.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Rita Redberg, UCSF. I've admired for a long time that NICE and thought, you know, it was a great way to kind of rationally look at what you were paying for. But it seems that there's been a major change in the kind of structure and influence of NICE recently, and I was wondering if you would comment on where that came from and whether you think it's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, again, it's come out of the change of government. Whether it ends up being a radical shift in the role of NICE and its authority remains to be seen. So I understand where your question is coming from, because there's been quite a lot of media coverage of the government's plans to dilute the influence that NICE has. Is that what you're getting at? Yeah. And that's part of this new government saying it wants to move away from such a centralized approach to the management of the health service. NICE exemplifies that, plus all the targets that I was talking about, plus we have what are called national service frameworks. So these are plans for improving cancer care, cardiac care, mental health care, and so on. And all of those are a legacy of the last government. Now, I'm sure the same is true here. Whenever you have a change of government, the new governors have very different ideas. They want to be different and to be seen to be different from their predecessors. So some of that is behind the plans for NICE and the shift to devolve budgets to a local level and to rely less in future on targets to drive change in the system. The reason I was expressing some doubt about whether that will make a substantial difference is the discussions we've been having with the emerging primary care physician groups, who, at least under the government's plans, will be free to depart from NICE guidance in future, suggests that actually they find it more convenient to have the NICE appraisals, their recommendations on drugs and devices and technologies to fall back on in deciding how to allocate their resources, because they are not able themselves to develop independent health technology assessment expertise. So one national expert source, widely respected now, not without controversy, but certainly well established as part of the architecture of the National Health Service, is useful to them in taking those more locally based decisions.
Hi, David Hopkins from Pacific Business Group on Health. You've indicated that for the British public, there are no worries about the cost of care. Very generous benefit package, no co-pays. How then do you control the utilization of preference-sensitive conditions and services relating to those, and patients choosing low-efficiency providers?
Yeah, okay. Largely through, I would say, the role of our primary care physicians. So every citizen is registered with a primary care practice. The primary care physicians in our system act as gatekeepers. I can't go to see a specialist in England without first seeing my primary care physician, and that primary care physician writing a letter of referral to the specialist, and that's how I then access specialist care. And that's, you know, one of the most important mechanisms for controlling demand and controlling cost. And there isn't a groundswell of opinion among the British public saying we want direct access to specialists, because primary care physicians are part of the fixtures and fittings of my healthcare system. People have got accustomed to working in that way. And even a younger generation that you might think would feel constrained by having to see the GP first before going to see the specialist seems to accept that as the way in which we run our healthcare services. So, I mean, that's the best answer I can give you. On preference-sensitive conditions, we're beginning to explore, as I know you are, ways of encouraging much more shared decision-making, providing more information, not just about where to get your care, but about the costs, the benefits, the risks of different treatment options, and trying to persuade our physicians to become much more partners in care. I'm not saying we're there. It's a long struggle.
We have time for one more question.
Thank you very much. I'm not a healthcare professional. We need help in this country, as you know. So what advice can you give us based on the fact that healthcare professionals are telling us, not healthcare professionals, but consultants, that a single-payer system in this country is a no-starter, that we have to contend with people who are shouting government takeover, socialism, death panels, et cetera, and we seem to have no defense against this.
Yeah.
So can you help us with what you, based on what you've learned with dealing with Kaiser or anybody else, what you think is doable in this country and who can do it?
Well, I think it's the doable that's important. I mean, one of the lessons I've learned throughout my career is that the healthcare systems that different countries have reflect their values, their traditions, their cultures, and their politics. And we could no more import your market-based system than you could import our national health system. It just doesn't fit within the culture and values that are important to you and your society. So I think it's about finding local solutions that do fit within that cultural context, finding practical, pragmatic, doable, to use your phrase, solutions. Was it Winston Churchill who said that Americans always end up finding the right solution, but only when they've exhausted all the alternatives? Yeah, well, no, no. Well, all I can say is viewing the recent debate about healthcare reform from a distance, you've made much more progress in the last couple of years in acting legislation that will move you towards universal coverage than you've made in the last 50 years. And politics often is a very slow, difficult, incremental process. Now, it may not be going as far and as fast as you and other people would wish, but you know, if it's better than where you were 2 or 3 years ago, then at least that's moving more in the right direction. But it is this combination, I think, of not just the coverage reform, the insurance reform, it's then really focusing on the payments and the delivery system changes that will deliver as much value as you can possibly get for the resources you put in. You spend an awful lot on healthcare in the United States. You are an outlier. Yeah. Compared with France and Germany, which also spend a lot more than my country, but you're way above them. So I think you've got beyond the flat of the curve. You've got into diminishing returns at a societal level.
And on that optimistic note, please join me in thanking our speaker, Chris Hamm.
Thank you.
And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.